Good morning, everybody. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. A lot's going on since the DOJ report came out, which we're going to cover during the course of this hour and the next hour. A lot of elements to this. Department of Justice came out with a report. Soon there'll be a consent decree to be signed by the City of Baltimore and the DOJ about our police department, reforming the police department. People say it will cost millions of dollars to implement. We'll talk about what that means and how that takes place. We also saw over the weekend the protests that took place at the Fraternal Order of the Police Convention here in Baltimore City, statewide convention of the FOP, by Be More Block and many of organizations that are allied with Be More Block. People were arrested. Their one statement was from Raleigh Kays, who's a frequent guest in this show, where he said the police union is a good old boys club that prioritizes the legal protection of officers over citizens and public safety and justice. We'll talk about what that means and the critique that the FOP's leadership is almost completely white in the state and definitely in the city of Baltimore. What does that mean and how is that significant? People are talking about other when you look at public safety, is it just all about police reform? And what does police reform mean? And are there other forms of public safety models that we're not even thinking about that could lead to peace in the communities and helping build community in Baltimore? Is that part of this discussion as well, or has it been? And Corinne Gaines' name was plastered all over people's T-shirts at the demonstrations on Saturday. And we always look at the Baltimore City Police, but this is solely a question of city police. There are issues in the county which don't often come to light, Baltimore County and other counties as well. So your thoughts on this. We look forward to your participation at 410-319-8888. You can email us, talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook page. I've seen a couple things here that I will try to read that came on our Facebook page, but they're really long, so it's hard to read really long pieces. But I'll try to digest what some of you said and wrote here and share that with our audience. We are here today with our guest, Todd Oppenheim's in the studio, a felony trial attorney in the Office of the Public Defender, and for 10 years has been representing indigent clients for district court and the circuit court, and of course ran for judge in the last election in the primary. Doug Ward is director of the Division of Public Safety Leadership in the School of Education at Johns Hopkins University, and spent 27 years in the Maryland State Police before he did that. Tara Hoffman is with us once again, director of OSI Baltimore's Criminal and Juvenile Justice Program. Brenda Saunders is with us, who is a community activist and executive director of Better Health, Better Life Organization, and you heard her on a program recently as part of co-organizer of the Vegan Soul Fest. And you all can join us again, 410-319-8888. So let me just turn directly to this DOJ report and what it's saying about the things that are lacking, because when you look at the report itself, and it's a huge report, and I've been waiting through this report, it's huge. But one of the things that struck me about this is it's not just about the, and we'll get to this really important part, not just about the kind of abuses, physical and sexual and other kind of abuse of citizens in the city and verbal abuse of citizens of the city, but it's about some really internal contradictions inside the police department, about failure to really solve cases, the lack of communication inside of a department, people not knowing what they're supposed to do, what leadership is telling officers on the line, a lot of those issues that I think most of us did not know about or didn't consider in this. Let me just start there, which is not the kind of frontline thing that most people think about, but clearly, Tara, and then could come to Doug. I mean, these are fundamental issues, and this is where when people say it's going to cost money to do this reform, this is where I think the money aspect comes in.
What I would say is that Baltimore City, I've been in the city now for 20 years. It's 20 years this month, and I have heard repeatedly that Baltimore's clearance rate in terms of crime is low. You know, it's below average, below the national average. It has improved somewhat, but as this report highlights, there are still a number of crimes that get committed in Baltimore City every day that are not solved. They're not solved because they're not responded to in a timely manner. They're not solved because the police officers don't take statements from people that they need to take statements from. They're not solved because the police department lacks the technology or other hardware or software that other cities may have in terms of being able to solve crimes. And so I would say that I think you would be hard-pressed to find a department that is as dysfunctional as the department is on the street when it comes to police community relations, but it's still clicking on all cylinders in every other part of the department. If you see dysfunction in one area, you're going to see it in other areas. And so I think that, again, the culture of the department and the way the department relates to the community, and that more than strained relationship, but even abusive relationship with the department and the community, is going to yield clearance rates that are nowhere near what they need to be in terms of solving crime and responding to it effectively.
And Doug Ward, it's what the report outlines, the things that saying that there's not adequate supervision for officers' enforcement activities. They don't provide adequate policy guidance and training to officers. That the fails to support its officers. They will not hold people responsible for misconduct. Adequate systems to investigate complaints and impose discipline don't exist. And so these are really huge pieces just internally inside the department.
Yeah, these are fundamental management systems that you would expect to be in any organization, and you would expect them to be able to survive over time. And so one of the things that I guess interests me about this is that we've been talking about many of these issues for years, right? And it's difficult for an organization and to become part of the organizational culture. This is, in other words, this is how we do it here, culture. That sometimes persists in a bad way when you have too many changes at the top. And if you look at Baltimore, one of the things that needs to be thought about is consistency in the leadership at the top. People in the lower part of the organization can wait it out. They'll just wait for the next leader to come, and we're going to still do it our way. And I've been watching this for a long time. To me, the most troubling part of this is when we had the influence from the New York people came down to Baltimore. We're going to do the zero tolerance and the city stat and that kind of thing. And it could be a positive thing, but I wasn't all that enamored in how it was implemented. And I think we just started chasing statistics at that point, and it's been downhill ever since.
And I would you all like to weigh in on this, Brenda, Todd?
The overall picture that I see from the report is that you have the government, and whether that's the federal government or the state government, it's the government. The government is making findings here in these specific areas, which aren't necessarily new or revelatory to anyone that's in the system, but the government is pointing out all these different aspects that are wrong with policing in Baltimore that the state and the government itself is often standing behind on a daily basis. So it takes the government itself to put us in a position where we can finally have a consent decree and go forward with change, and it's only because the system itself that has been perpetuating all this is finally calling itself out. It's crazy. I mean, it's good. I feel good that we're to this point, but we've been talking about it for so long, and it takes the government itself to point this out.
Brenda?
Yeah, I think my biggest concern in all of that is that there are no systems in place to track, to document, and to make assessments of what is actually going on within the department. And so it makes me feel pretty hopeless until those systems are put in place that anything will actually change.
You know, one of the things that the police commissioner said in this show, and I think other police commissioners have said similar things in this program over the last 20-some years, is that we're dealing with we want to weed out the bad actors in the police department. And so the question is, what is a bad actor? What does that mean? And I was thinking about the show, the program we produced on Friday, which was this two-hour documentary that we did here at the Center for Emerging Media that Stephanie Mavronis, senior producer who is now off to graduate school, produced with Power Inside, and interviewing the women and taking the interviews of the women who testified to the Department of Justice about their abuse sexually and physically and verbally from the police department in Baltimore, many of whom were addicted, women who worked the streets as sex workers. And those women we interviewed were almost all, to a person almost, now in recovery, but they all testified to being used by officers for sex so they wouldn't be arrested, officers getting them drugs so they wouldn't be to keep them as informants, and all those other things that go on like that. And so while those cops who did that may have been at the worst end of the spectrum of a police officer and their duties, they had to be supported in silence by the men and women around them who knew what was going on. I mean, because you know what's happening. It's not like you can't not be on patrol and not work with another fellow officer. Just like we couldn't work here at this radio station, you couldn't work at the OSI knowing that somebody was doing something completely corrupt and wrong in the middle of your business and not say anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of getting into the heart of this issue, I think.
Bad actors in any organization, bad actors will thrive in a culture of unaccountability because they can hide. And they can explain their actions away. And so whenever you're dealing with an organization and you want to identify and try to weed out the bad actors, your first step is not to go after the bad actors. Your first step is to step back and say, okay, what is it about my organization that is allowing those individuals to still remain, that is not bringing them to our attention in real ways, preventing others from bringing them to our attention. There's something in the system. As Doug said, there's something in the culture that allows those bad actors to thrive in a culture of accountability, in a culture where you can track things, evaluate things, collect data, analyze the data, say what the data, you know, figure out what the data is telling you. You can more easily, I'm not going to say you're going to be able to weed out every bad actor, but you can more easily identify who the bad actors are. You can determine whether it's just a matter of retraining, or you can determine whether or not you need to separate or sever this person from the organization so they don't continue to bring the organization down. But it's not just that bad actor. That bad actor is able to thrive and survive because there's something in the system of the organization that allows him or her to do so.
And a good example of that on a parallel is we take all of our students down to the National Holocaust Museum, and one of the things we look at there is bystander behavior and the lack of bystander intervention. And so a lot of people in an organization, it's easy to be a bystander and just kind of turn your head the other way because you don't want to create ripples. But there's a lot of really bad things that can occur. And if you look throughout history of people who knew what was going on but didn't want to know and just didn't pay attention. And a lot of that's what's going on. And this is not just Baltimore, but organizations around the country, right? So you're right.
There's politics.
There's a climate that has to be there. Now, so one of the ways to get around that is instead of I call it policing to a community as opposed to policing with a community. But you have to look at things like theories of justice. You know, if you're doing a job as a police officer to provide justice, that justice is provided to every person, regardless. So you just can't. I think maybe this is the wrong word, but I think sometimes some police dehumanize certain segments of the population, and I think that is so wrong. But I worry that part, once you do that, just like in a war, once you dehumanize the enemy, it becomes an us and them, and that is just. It perpetuates the wrong approach.
Well, one of the things that has been said about this police department, but I think most police departments, and I think it's common in other organizations as well, but clearly common in police departments, is, you know, people are always rail against the code of silence in the street. Stop snitching. But there's a code of silence among police that is just as deep.
If not deeper.
and so that becomes part of how do you break through that? Because if you are part of an organization that feels itself embattled mm-hmm. on numbers of levels because you are soldiers in the street as opposed to peace officers, then there's a mindset that goes with that. And that code of silence is part of the – I mean, how does any police reform measures deal with that?
Well, I think one of he has many, but one of Commissioner Davis's biggest challenge is going to be how does he break through that? How does he begin to transform the culture of the department so that those individuals within the department who see this behavior, see this conduct of some of their fellow officers and want to say something about it, feel supported enough to be able to come forward, because we've seen the stories of the few officers who did come forward and say something and they were just completely ostracized. They were completely blackballed or blacklisted. They were suspended or they felt a need to resign. And so just as in a street crime, you may have a witness who is not going to come forward if he or she feels like if I say something, they're going to come after me and I will become the next victim. That is very much the case within police departments all over the nation, including the Baltimore Police Department. And I don't have the magic answer for that one, but that's going to be one of Commissioner Davis's first challenges, is how do I create something within my department so that officers feel protected and they feel like I'm going to have their back if they come forward and begin to point up these things within the department that need to be fixed, including individual officers that, again, either need to be retrained, brought up on some sort of disciplinary action, or invited to leave the police department and, you know, make their living elsewhere.
Todd, go ahead. Then we'll come turn back to Doug.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that maybe starting with the recruits that come in and the mindset of the recruits. I heard Commissioner Davis say at an association meeting that the key, the one word that he wants to hear from people is they want to serve. They want to serve the community. And I think there's this militaristic mindset behind policing and arresting and making numbers and, you know, seizing this and that versus serving the community. Once you start weeding out that element, you know, it's going to be the dead wood that has to move out of the departments, but it's got to be a different type of recruit that comes in.
So you're exactly right. So you start at the front end of the who do we hire, right, in an organization to change it. Who do we hire? Who do we praise and promote? And who do we fire, right? People see that in the organization, and that sends us clear, loud message. I'd also like to see us be able to recruit people from within the city to become police officers and civil servants of all types, people who have a stake in living in the city. I'd like to see incentives for people to come in and serve and live here in the city. And so that's going to maybe cost some money and that kind of thing. But and then, you know, when the organizational culture sees that the real bad apples, the ones that, you know, you read about, and those are the few maybe, but there is this sense of somehow they've got this either people turning their heads and allowing it or ignoring it. When people see them go out the door, many people in the middle will change. So a lot of the studies that have been done on corruption and reporting of corruption and whistleblowing and so forth, on minor things are more likely to be reported by other officers the more serious things are more likely to be reported than the minor. So if there's a whole bunch of minor things in the middle that are overlooked, well, that creates a really bad situation. But if you bring good people in the front door, some people are not going to be part of the solution and they're going to need to go. There's going to need to be authority to do that. You may have to bring in people who are willing to come in and live and be part of the city and try and get people from the city. Kids, start at small kids and be a good role model and get back into the schools if you're a police officer and start doing the talks that went away years ago and bring in some more community policing philosophy that can and it's going to take years. You can't just flip a switch on this.
Brenda?
Wow. I don't have much faith that the solution is to bring in more people from the communities to the police departments, because, you know, if the system is still the same, if there's still the same expectations of the officers, then they're going to do what they believe is their job. You know, if high arrest is what they feel like that, you know, is expected of them, then they're going to do that. And so I think that's not necessarily the answer. I think that the answer is going to definitely have to come at like a systemic level from within the department.
So, you know, when there's so many levels to this. I mean, mm-hmm. So we are at a precipice, as many other cities have been. There have been over 20 cities in America that have been under these consent decrees. And one study I was looking at earlier this morning from Blue Nation Review and a couple of the pieces I was reading raised the question, in the long run, do these decrees really mean anything? Have they changed transparency worked at the beginning of these things, like in Washington, D.C., and in Detroit and other places, but then it ended after in L.A., after the decree was over, the transparency also left. And whether when we look at what this model is going to be, are we just going to have the DOJ talking to the police department and some people in the city government and not have real community input and participation in how we talk about what we need? I mean, that's part of the problem. Is this is not just about writing a check and taking money away from Parks and Rec, taking money away from education or Department of Public Works and putting it into the police department, which is what I fear is about to happen. And instead of really wrestling with what the community wants out of this and how the community voice and participation takes place in this process, which might really lead to some change, maybe.
Maybe. And I will say that there are many activist groups out there who feel the same as you do, Mark. They have no faith in the consent decree process. They have not attempted to engage the investigation or the consent decree process, and they have no intention of doing so. There are other groups, however, that have engaged the investigation. They are engaging. They engaged around the findings letter, and they're going to continue to engage around the consent decree. And when Open Society Institute Baltimore put out our statement, one of the things that we said needed to happen next is that just as DOJ reached out to the community and engaged them during the investigations, that same level of, even greater level of engagement has to happen around the consent decree. This cannot be a conversation between DOJ, PPD, and the mayor. This has to be a conversation. The community has to own the consent decree and the monitoring of the consent decree, which means that the community has to help draft and negotiate what the consent decree is. If it remains a purely government conversation and government function of the consent decree, where you only get a little bit of input from the community, that's when you're going to get a document that looks really pretty. It sits on the shelf somewhere, and 7 years from now, some monitors does exactly what happened with the ACLU litigation, which says 4 years have gone by and they haven't done anything to improve upon what it is we said. We will get the exact same result if the community is not thoroughly engaged in helping to draft and negotiate and monitor implementation of this consent decree.
So that's been the hardest, because I was going to raise the ACLU agreement that took place, and that doesn't seem to have had much of an effect.
Ask how many people in Baltimore City know about it.
Right. I mean, we know about it because we covered it.
Exactly.
But what were you going to say, Doug?
But just, you know, the way things are supposed to work is the community, you know, elects political leaders, and that's the place to engage the government, is to make people's voices heard by the elected officials. They do respond to that. I know that, you know, it's difficult to do sometimes, but I think their ears are open now. One of the opportunities I think we're all presented with here is that this report takes this discussion to a new level. It's findings of a thoughtful process by a reputable organization, the DOJ, that clearly takes this out of the, you know, the I say this and you say that, or I think this and you think that, and we've all heard the stories, but it's not been listened to as this will be listened to, because this is now documented many things that many people have been trying to make their voices heard with. But it gives government officials, it gives all of us something to point to and say, well, at least, you know, it's not a perfect document, but at least it's a place to start, and it's done where we can all kind of take it as an opportunity to move forward and get out of the argument of is this happening or not. I mean, I think we can now say, okay, let's assume this is where we are. This is documented that it's happened. Now let's fix it together, you know. So I think that this is an opportunity. Now we can blow this opportunity, and other cities mm-hmm. have done that. But I hope everyone takes a chance to, you know, use this to move forward in a positive direction.
And I absolutely agree with Doug that, you know, we do, you know, we're a representative government, and so we do sort of, you know, speak through our representatives. But I would also, because of the history and but because we know of past incidents, I would say that we have to resist any expectation that, you know, DOJ and the current mayor and the incoming mayor are going to look at the community and say, we got this. No. Yeah. We're, you know, the community has to be at the table and on guard at all times, making sure that they have a say in what's going to happen next and that they are there to help monitor to make sure that it happens.
We're going to take a short break, come back, and come back to Brenda and Todd and to the phones of 410-319-8888. LaVon, Ernest, and Floyd, we'll get to your calls when we come back. And I think that as we go to break, to say there is this disconnect, I think, and it's not about the elected officials, because even though we elect these officials, there are things like the No Boundaries Coalition, which put out their own report before DOJ ever came out, that says that attests to what the DOJ report was talking about, and this came out of the community. How do they participate in this process? How do we change the nature of public safety in the city? Can it be done? We're going to be looking at alternative models in the coming weeks and on this program. Join us. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I am here with Todd Oppenheim, who is a felony trial lawyer with the Office of Public Defender, Doug Ward, retired Maryland State Police officer, major, right? Director of the Division of Public Safety Leadership in the School of Education at Johns Hopkins University, Tara Huffman, who is director of the OSI Baltimore's Criminal and Juvenile Justice Program, and Brenda Sanders, executive director of Better Health Life Organization, Better Health, Better Life Organization, and a community activist, and you all at 410-319-8888. And I am going to go right to the phones here. We're going to go to LaVon and Ernest and Floyd in that order. But let me just throw something out I said during the break and see what we all think. That I said, you know, all right, so we have this, what's coming, a coming dissent decree. That, I mean, there's nothing anybody in this room or in the city can stop that from happening. It's going to happen. DOJ is going to come out with what they think their recommendations are. The city is going to have to sign the agreement with the DOJ, and they have to implement these reforms in X period of time, whatever that period of time is. And so, and all that's very important, I think. And it's going to cost, they said, anywhere from $5 to $15 million. Do I have that right? I think that number is somewhere in there.
That sounds conservative, but
right.
Okay.
So the question I had, though, is the answer solely in reforming police, which I think is part of the answer. But is there another part of this answer that we never even talk about? Are there other forms of public health, safety, and healing that can be implemented with the same dollars and to implement something different? And what I've said was taking safe streets and expanding that out into a much bigger program, taking the women from power inside and out for justice, former sex workers and ex-offenders, and letting them become the health workers in those communities that help heal a community and bring them together. I use the example all the time when that 13-year-old boy, whose name I'm blocking on this moment, was shot by the police in his leg because he had a toy gun that looked real. And if there were men and women out in the community who were actually working in the community to help keep peace, they would have walked over that little boy and said, "What are you doing? What is that in your hand? Give me that. Where's your mother?" It would have been a very different interaction. The boy would never have been shot. And maybe instead of arresting people, we could have community conferencing, community mediation for things from broken windows to stolen cars to a number of things that community conferencing has shown they can do to kind of change things and heal things as opposed to arresting our way out of the problem. I mean, I think it's not just about reforming the police. I mean, I don't think we even got a handle on what that means to reform the police.
No, and it's like I said on the show last week, I think in far too many instances, we are asking law enforcement to respond and intervene in places that they're not the best intervention. It is something that with the proper supports, the community can handle on its own. I'm getting ready to age myself, but there was a time when if there was a beef between two young men in the community, you didn't call the police. Somebody went and told one mother, somebody went and told the other mother or the grandmother, and they got in the street and they took both of them by the ear and they made it slap them around a little bit. But before it was over, the beef was squashed and no law enforcement was ever engaged in that. And those young men didn't grow up to resent each other. And so we feel far removed from those days. because our communities have been so under-resourced and divested from for so long, that that kind of infrastructure is not as present as it used to be. And so the question becomes, how do we reinvest in that infrastructure so that community can mediate its own conflicts, can respond to issues presented by someone who has a mental health challenge, you know, and they call, you know, social workers and mental health experts, as opposed to calling the police, who are not social workers and are not mental health experts. And when they show up, they got a gun on one hip, they got a taser on the other, they got a baton somewhere around them. And so they're, you know, they may default to the tools that are most readily available to them and the ones that they've been trained on. What can be done before you ever call that officer into the situation in the first place?
And, I will add here, I'm going to get Brenda and Todd, I'm going to open the phones here. I will add, caveat I added last time, we have also unraveled into society because people are so isolated and desperate in the worlds they've been isolated into in the last 40, 50 years of this country, that it's also become an armed camp. Mm. And we can't forget that part. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of guns in the streets of Baltimore. Mm. There are 300 people a year dying from gunshot wounds, from being shot in the streets of Baltimore, and thousands more who have been wounded in the streets of Baltimore. So, you know, so that's a reality too. So, I mean, I think that we forget that in some of the process of this. And I use this stat all the time, and I'll say it again, Brenda, is that in America, in the last 30 years, until 2013, from 1993, 262,000 black men have been murdered in this country. Murdered in this country. Maybe 10 to 15%, if that, of that are with law enforcement. But other than that, that number, and you multiply that times 5 or more in terms of the effect it has on people and communities and family, that's huge. I mean, that's genocide on some levels. I mean, you could discuss it in that way. Brenda.
Yeah, and so I was interested in addressing this issue of, you know, the community has to come to the table. The community has to be a part of fixing these issues. And the problem I see with that is that, you know, in reading through this DOJ report, which I've done twice now, and now I'm highlighting, the people who are most affected by this police misconduct are the very people who probably won't be at the table, because there's so much trauma that's been involved generationally with, you know, these kinds of harassment and brutalization and, you know, and killings and such, that there's such a deep fundamental lack of trust and lack of any kind of hope that anything could even come out of being at the table, not to mention the economic marginalization and struggling to survive. And so there's a lot of different issues that are all kind of intertwining to make the situation the way that it is. And I think that we're going to have to pick apart each piece and look at each piece of that before we start talking about bringing the community to the table in any substantive way.
So how do you wrestle that in light of the fact that there is going to be this DOJ decree with the city of Baltimore's police department that has to be dealt with? So, I mean, when that happens, people have to push for something in the process of that, no?
And it's going to happen. I mean, the community leaders that are already pretty outspoken are going to speak, and this decree is going to, you know, be drafted, and maybe something will happen with it, and maybe it won't.
Todd?
In terms of the homicides, I think it's important to keep that as a separate and distinct discussion. I don't think excessive policing or misconduct is an appropriate response to the level of violence in the city. I mean, I see them as independent problems. And then in terms of what we can do, keeping a spotlight, I think, on the system. I see everything from kind of the back end in the courts, where cases will come in and we deal with policing as they play out in the courts. But as we've learned, that's maybe 95% of the incidents on the street are not what I'm seeing in court. But the small percentage that does play out, we have to keep an eye on. We have to keep pressure on judges, on prosecutors, who are pursuing cases where people's rights are violated. And those are instances where crimes are charged, and a lot of people say, well, no, there's a gun involved, there's drugs involved. But those are the rights that are constantly being skirted and shorted, and then it carries over into incidents like you see in the DOJ report. And it doesn't really extend to courts as much, but if we keep a focus on it, as we did during most of the trials of the Freddie Gray officers, it just can't fade away.
Doug, I'm going to hit the phone here. People are dying to join in. Go ahead.
Well, I think lots of people want a quick fix, and there's no quick fix for any of this. So, when you said about the homicides, I mean, to me, asking the police to prevent a homicide is way too late very, very difficult.
Right.
Maybe in a domestic violence where you've been to the residence several times, you could intervene. The rest of these, the police are too late in the process. Where are we working on drug addiction? Where are we working on lead paint? Where are we working on hopelessness? Where are we working on why is Baltimore a major hub for illegal drugs, guns, and it's been for years? Why we have the federal government arresting doctors for prescriptions over prescribing opioids, and then we have a heroin issue popping up across the country and addiction. Where are we dealing with supply, the demand for these things out in the counties? Baltimore's just the shopping center, to come and get the drugs. Why is someone affiliate with a gang as opposed to being able to have the opportunity to have hope and have, I'm going to get a good education and a good job, and I'm going to be healthy? Where's, prenatal care? Where's housing? Where's affordable, we could go on and on and on. And it's pretty soon our heads just want to explode because it's so hard to fix. But those are the fixes for murders. It starts in prenatal care. It starts in creating hope for the future. I mean, we know why people affiliate with gangs. I mean, these things have been studied. It's not like we don't have the answers, but we don't have the guts as a country to spend the money and the effort and the time to fix these intractable problems. That's frustrating.
Yeah, and we're finally starting to stop criminalizing everything. We base this system of justice around everything has to be prosecuted and tried, where there's police models now where they're diverting people upon arrest for drug treatment at police districts in different locales around the country. I get cases where victims want to talk to me about, why does this need to go forward? And I have to tell them, well, I'm on the other side, why? And then I say, why'd you get the police involved in the first place? And they say, well, maybe I shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. And you can't stop that train once it starts rolling. And it's just taking a different perspective from everything and stop looking to the justice system for these answers, because most people are going to be released from prison at some point.
And I think let me go to the phones here and to follow up. I think that there are very few police officers who prevent crime.
Hmm.
They investigate and solve crime.
After the fact.
Right? And if you're growing up in a neighborhood, same way I did as a kid, and there's a gang coming after you, you're going to arm yourself to protect yourself. You're not going to call the police, and you're not going to tell your parents. You're going to have to take care of yourself. You and your boys are going to take care of whatever's coming at you. People forget that's part of what happens in reality, mm-hmm. And that over half the young men in the city carrying weapons are not gangbangers.
They're protecting themselves.
They're protecting themselves from what's going on around them. I mean, we forget this is part of the life of the world of the poorest people in this city and in this country.
Gangbangers don't carry kitchen knives.
And sometimes the protection is from law enforcement.
It is. But the reality is that when kids are on the street, they're not carrying guns to shoot the police.
No. Mm-hmm.
They're carrying guns to protect themselves from what's around them, not to go after the police. 410-319-8888. Let's go to LaVon. You're on the air.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
It's a very interesting panel. I agree with a lot of things you're saying, and I believe, as you already stated, there's not one thing that's the issue. I was looking at some statistics about how Baltimore City is actually over-policed. There's information out there that says that Baltimore City has 55 police officers per 10,000 people, about 620,000 population, and other cities, major cities, have a higher population than ours, maybe there they have something like 30 police per every 10,000. And I'm thinking, with all of those extra police that we have, Idle Minds, Devil's Workshop, they didn't have anything else to do but abuse and torment people. So that's some of the issue too. If they were, if not so many, maybe we could utilize the resources of the police and laws to really take care of crime, to solve problems with crime and stuff like that. A lot of the issues too is also poverty that's in Baltimore City. They did a study at Harvard that talked about how we have a negative 17% opportunity to get out of poverty if you live in Baltimore City. So the location, we're of the top five worst places to live in order to pull people out of poverty because of the redlining that we have, that racism, that since Jim Crow time in 1910, it still exists. And it's been sanctioned by most of the institutions in Baltimore. When the commissioner Bates came to Baltimore, that was the first thing that he recognized, saying that he thought he was back in the 50s, where the racism was so dominant, that you couldn't really get anything done. So, and then we have, inequities in the judicial system where the appointed judges, the same that we have in the Supreme Court, the bias between being a Democrat and a Republican, they carry those same kind of biases. And the judge who tried over the Frederick Gray case, mm-hmm. he was appointed by Ehrlich. So he has the same kind of mindset as the conservative, kind of like Clarence Thomas. I mean, how could we thought we would have gotten a fair trial? He threw away evidence. He ignored the fact that the guy was, homicide killed, not given medical assistance. He wasn't seatbelted. All the things that are the law, but all of that was ignored. And then we find out why, because look what's been going on in Baltimore City with the police. So it's not a one issue thing. We have a lot of issues that we have to deal with. As the politicians have ignored us. That's why we have Trump and Bernie on both sides of the spectrum. So politicians are not the answer. They've never been for the past 40 years. They don't rightly represent us. So that's something that the people are really going to have to be involved with. When the last time they called a town meeting from our politicians? They've never. The FBI, the Justice Department called a town meeting. And some of the people that were there as far as our politicians, they were shocked. So they're not the answer. So apologize for what's going on with the police department is not the answer. We need people to be held accountable as far as jail time. That's a part of the solution.
Levon, appreciate the call. And I mean, starting with what you said in the beginning, Baltimore does have one of the highest per capita in terms of per 10,000. Baltimore has, I was looking it up as you were speaking, the second high, one of the highest in the nation, 47.4 officers per 10,000 people in the city, as opposed to New York that has 41. But, I mean, it's high, but not like exorbitantly high, but it is clearly high. And that's another question. I mean, so that I think those are all very real issues. I would just say the judge. I don't think the judge is a conservative Republican. He was appointed by a Republican governor, but the governor appointed mostly Democrats and stuff, and it's the judgeships in the state. But that neither here, notwithstanding.
I would not describe Judge Williams as conservative.
Mm-hmm. No, you would not describe him as conservative.
And I think that even Marilyn Mosby in her press conference that she gave when she announced that she was dropping charges against the remaining officers, I think that she even went out of her way to make it known that she was not targeting Judge Williams and his decisions. Her statement, I could try this case 10,000 times in 10,000 ways and still get the same result. That wasn't a dig at Judge Williams. That was just a dig at the fact of just the process. The evidence that was available to her, the evidence that was not available to her for one reason or another. And she just sort of realized, there's nothing's going to change. I'm sort of handcuffed, pun not intended. And so I don't think that she was blaming Judge Williams.
So let me get one quick call in here to get you all have some thoughts here before we take a break for the news. 410-319-8888. Lydia, you're on the air. Welcome. Lydia, good morning. We have Lydia on line one? All right. Let's try to go to Ernest on line three.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning to you and your guests. the way you're trying to take up for Judge Williams, that's the problem, in my estimation. This thing has been going on since Commissioner Schmidt was the police commissioner.
That's a long time ago.
That was a long time ago. Now, what they did, Marvin Mandel was in charge of the police department after that. He brought in General Gelston, Box Harris, because of the same type of incidents. General Gelston didn't stay, then they brought in Pomelo, and that was his job. And when you went against the grain, against Pomelo, you got fired. They wouldn't indict you. They wouldn't indict you. They wouldn't send you to jail, but Pomelo would fire you quick after the trial board. Now, it's not just the Baltimore City Police Department. It's the state of Maryland. And the people, and nothing's going to happen. The only good thing we have is Marilyn Mosby. The fact that police saw that these six officers put a healthy black man in the back of a cruiser, and then he came out, and a week later he died. Police looked at that all over the United States, and they said, we got away with that. So they're not paying the courts and anybody no mind. That's why they're still killing people. Now, even with the state police was profiling on 695 black people, the state police. So, and the only way that you're going to stop criminal cops is to prosecute them and to send them to jail. That's the only thing that they're afraid of, being prosecuted, found guilty, and to send them to jail. Even the juries, when you put a jury out there, they do not like to find police guilty of the major charges and things like this. They'll bring it down to disorderly conduct or something like that. But the fact that Judge Williams, with all the charges, and I think they was appropriate, I worked the wagon for 15 years. That never happened to me or anyone else at the time that I was a police officer, where somebody got their vertebrae neck broken in the back of a wagon, handcuffed and hogtied. I mean, that's ridiculous.
All right, Ernest, let me let the panel have that before we have to break for this news. You want to say some quick talk? Because sure. I know you're leaving at the hour and let you have your thought.
If we're going to have any integrity in the justice system whatsoever, then you got to stand by the verdict of that case. There was absolutely no evidence presented during the trial that would have led to convictions. I could not be a bigger proponent to deal with police misconduct and abuse in the street and to clean up the police department and start from top to bottom. But I watched the trial. I paid attention. I understand the law. And if there's anyone to look at, it's the state on this issue. The state is lucky that Judge Williams didn't grant a motion for judgment of acquittal before the defense even put on their cases in certain trials. To look and say that, well, this is a great move. But if you prosecute cases to this level, what does it say for the average defendant that we're stuck in court with every day? That's in jail. That's poor. It has to be the same level of justice for everyone.
So let me ask this question real quick before we go. This is really interesting to me. We've talked about this. We've had this debate on the show a lot. But and I don't want to get stuck on the trial around the officers and Freddie Gray. But, I mean, the part of the issue is, was it the law itself and the difficulty in prosecuting police officers as was at the bottom of why you could not get this prosecution to go through? Was it because it was just completely unknown how Freddie Gray really died, yes, and at which point it happened? It was difficult to pinpoint. I mean, what is that reality?
It was the facts of this incident. If you compare and contrast it with an incident like Tyrone West, the death of Tyrone West, or Anthony Anderson, where people are assaulted at the hands, literally, of police officers, the level of proof for even a first-degree assault is so much easier to reach than issues of criminal negligence.
And these officers were not prosecuted for either of those deaths.
They weren't. And Mosby's office will not reopen those investigations in the face of putting on a much more difficult prosecution. So I don't see the consistency there.
So let me ask the other lawyer in the house here.
No, Sarah? I would say that there are people in the community, you know, when first of all, I think that Marilyn Mosby's decision to bring charges had value. And so I don't criticize her at all. I think it took great courage for her to do that, and I think that the fervor for with which she went after this and tried to truly bring a case that would hold these officers accountable in the courts was the right thing for her to do in terms of being the state's attorney for Baltimore City. I will say, on the other side, there are people in the community, non-lawyers, who sort of said, we'll never get a verdict just because it's the police. Well, I will also say that there are people in the legal community who took a look at the case and said, we're probably not going to get a verdict out of this, only because the evidence was so, it was never a slam dunk from the beginning. Mm-hmm. It was going to be a war and a battle from the very beginning. And there are people who, again, who are trained as lawyers, who understand evidence and what needs to be presented to get a guilty finding in a court of law, which has the highest legal standard in terms of findings, you know, that exists. And we just sort of said, I don't know about this one, you know, but that doesn't mean that she should have backed off. It doesn't mean that she should have went away. But it was going to be tough from the very, very beginning. And so when the guilty verdicts or the mistrial started coming down, there are people within the legal community that we weren't shocked. We weren't shocked. And so I think that it's, again, not taking up for Judge Williams or for Ms. Mosby, but simply to say that when it comes to prosecuting officers, I think that the outcome of this case just helps to highlight, again, there is so little accountability when it comes to law enforcement and holding law enforcement officers in a criminal manner, how you gather evidence, what evidence is made available to whom, at what point, you know, during the investigation. It's just difficult to prosecute, period. And I think that this case highlights. I don't think that anyone should. I just want to. It'd be very difficult to, you know, make that argument to someone who wanted to see a guilty verdict, because a healthy young man went into the back of that van and died, and the only people who touched him were police officers. Somebody did something wrong. But I think it just highlights, again, there's such a culture of unaccountability within systems. All throughout the criminal justice system, that holding an officer accountable, what else needs to be done in terms of consent decree, in terms of reform, so that you can actually hold officers criminally accountable for when they injure or cause the death of an individual.
We do have to take a short break here. We're going to come right back. And with the continuous conversation, I'll take a news break here on WEA. We'll be back with this conversation. We'll be adding a guest. I want to thank Todd Oppenheim. It's always great to have you here, man. You're wonderful. I want to leave with a tweet from Theodore Bracey. Theodore Bracey tweeted in, I pray the FOP and Mayor Stephen Rawlings Blake are listening to the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA. I hope so as well. Mm-hmm. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back, everybody. Good to have you here with us on the Mark Steiner Show, on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Brenda Sanders is here, Executive Director of Better Health, Better Life Organization. Tara Hoffman is Director of OSI Baltimore's Criminal and Juvenile Justice Program. Doug Ward is Director of the Division of Public Safety Leadership in the School of Education at Johns Hopkins University and is a retired major of the Maryland State Police. And Michaela Duchess Brown has joined us in studio. She is head of communications for Be More Block, one of the lead organizations that did the demonstration at the FOP convention over the weekend here in Baltimore. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can email us, talk@steinershow.org, tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can also log on to our Facebook pages, but do join us, 410-319-8888. And so let me just turn a bit here, since Michaela, let me get that mic a little closer to your face than we can. There we go. Now we got your voice. Welcome. Good to have you on the program again.
Thank you for having me.
So talk. I just want to take a step back here. I think it's important since you're here to kind of talk a bit about the FOP convention. I'm going to turn to Doug, ask Doug about that world of Fraternal Order of Police. But you launched a demonstration, you and other allied organizations, but Be More Block and Lead, I would take it. Talk a bit about why you did that and what was happening that Saturday. And 12 of you were arrested as well, right?
Yes. So there were about 60 protesters, 12 arrested intentionally.
Civil disobedience.
Yes, right. For civil disobedience. We had a rally outside to show support to those who actually put their bodies on the line on the inside by chaining themselves to block entrances, as well as the escalator to the actual conference so people couldn't get registered. And the purpose for being there was to disrupt the FOP conference because the FOP stands in the way of police accountability. And so if we're going to take on police accountability, we have to take on the FOP because they do a really good job at protecting officers who commit crimes.
So let's talk a minute about this whole role. And one of the things I know that was one of the critiques of the FOP was that there were no people of color on their board of leadership, though there are two statewide, two people from Prince George's County, but none here in Baltimore. And Baltimore, as a matter of fact, with our history of segregation, has actually two organizations, right? There's the Fraternal Order of Police, which was always the white group. And then when black folks were actually allowed to become officers, they formed their own organization called Vanguard Justice Society, which is the organization of African-American officers, which does not have the same political power as FOP in terms of negotiating contracts with the city and more. Just that's a really kind of important feature. So, I mean, talk a bit about from your experience all those years in the police force, because I'm sure there was an FOP with the state police as well, right?
Sure. In the state police, I mean, it's a similar story, right? So before the 1970s was basically you had to be a white male and you had to be a tall white male to get in. There were all kind of obstacles to women and to different races and ethnicities. And so there were two groups. There's the Maryland Troopers Association, and then there's the Coalition of Black Maryland State Troopers.
Still.
I think to this day and age, it amazes me, though. I don't know why we still perpetuate that. But there may be certain valid reasons, right? So if I was in the African-American community, I may feel that maybe the unions don't represent me and my needs as well as they should. So maybe there's some valid reasons that it exists today. But, I mean, I think it's a fact that there are these factions. But they're advocacy organizations, and if they want to advocate for their particular needs, That's what they do. So I don't think we should be surprised that they're going to, if they're the union or the Fraternal Order of Police, they're going to stand behind their members.
Right. I mean, the question and how we define that is the question, what that means. And I think that's, you look askance, Michaela, before I turn to Tara. You about to say something?
No.
Okay. So Tara, Brenda, do you want to jump in on that?
Well, I would say that, you know, the FOP is supposed to function the way any union functions, which is represent worker to management to make sure that worker gets fair wage, worker cannot be dismissed arbitrarily, terminated arbitrarily. And so, you know, Open Society Institute Baltimore, other liberal organizations, and I think just, you know, the common man out there, the common worker, we support unions. We think that unions serve a valuable purpose. The question becomes, at what point does a union stop serving the purpose of a union, which is making sure the worker gets fair treatment, and actually becomes, as Michaela said, a hindrance to accountability, and sort of becomes the force whereby somehow holding an officer accountable for his or her actions is equated to mistreatment. Like that can't be the equation, that if you try to hold one of my guys accountable, you're mistreating my person. You know, at some point the union has to be able to say, you know, has to be the body of people that says, you know, for the protection of the workers, you know, we also have to, you know, internally be able to look at a fellow worker and say, okay, you are no longer representing us. You are no longer helping. You're actually hurting. your other workers, you're actually hurting the union, and we're not going to stand in the way of you being held accountable for behavior that no union should uphold. And so that just becomes the question. Has the Baltimore City FOP, has any FOP around the state, you know, are they functioning like the way a union should function, or are they functioning as something to hinder any accountability whatsoever and therefore help are complicit in the mistreatment and the abuse that citizens of Baltimore, residents of Baltimore, and even visitors to Baltimore City are experiencing on a daily basis?
The only thing I want to say is that I completely support Michaela and Be More Block in, you know, the disruption of the FOP conference. I think it is a wonderful thing that they're doing by highlighting it and bringing to the public's attention the ways in which the FOP works to, in a lot of cases, shield and protect officers who are engaging in criminal misconduct. And so they have my complete support.
Let me get to the heart of something a little different here. And I, as someone who lived through the 60s and everything that happened then and student of history, in 1967 there was a rebellion in Detroit that was huge. I shouldn't say huge because I sound like Donald Trump. But
huge.
but there was a rebellion in Detroit. And on the heels of that rebellion, even before the explosions in 1968 after the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The government then, under President Lyndon Johnson, appointed what they called the Kerner Commission, which investigated issues of the police and issues of racism and poverty in America. And they went; it became a national focus. There's only one person left from that. There's former Senator Harris. He's the only person left alive from that commission. And I watched a speech he gave just a while ago. I'd love to interview him before he passes. He's really old at this point, almost 90. But he said recently that if we had followed what we said in the Kerner Commission, we wouldn't be facing what we're facing today in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's what he said.
Yep.
Which had to do with an all-out war on poverty and racism in America and changing the nature of the fabric of society and changing the nature of how we police our communities and what policing means. And so there's two things. A, 49 years later, we're still wrestling with some of the same issues that the Kerner Commission put out in 1967. And B, is it time now, not for another, I'm so sick of commissions, but another kind of push to really idea politically to say what we have to do to change the society has to be as radical as they were saying around the Kerner Commission, which really wasn't that radical a report.
And Mark, you know, I like you, I'm a contemporary, and I remember being – we were told it was communists. It was communism who was causing the riots in the streets. It was communism who was calling the protests for racial justice, and it was a communist that were at fault for everything. Now we're being told it's the terrorists that are responsible for everything, and we're going to fight the war on terrorism. And the Kerner Commission came back and said, no communists here.
Right.
It's poverty. It's racism.
It's poverty.
And we're still dealing with it.
I was at a meeting where Congressman Harris was invited to, and he read portions of the Kerner Commission report.
Yeah.
And I had never heard of it before. It was before my time.
Interesting. It
was never taught in my history lessons. It wasn't part of my class.
That's interesting. Yeah. And you were a learned woman.
And I am a very learned woman.
You are.
But as he was reading sections and portions of the report, I remember looking at my peers in Baltimore City, and we were like, they could have freaking wrote this report yesterday. I mean, I cannot tell you word for word sections of that report that he was reading. It was like the commission just released that report yesterday, and it was focused on Baltimore City, and it just talked about why we were where we were, you know, this many years later. So you, on the one hand, you can sort of hear that and be like, well, you know, 49 years later, and this is where we are. Like, what was the point? But to your point about whether we need another commission, I know I've often heard people say, not all, but I've often heard people say that there was this war on poverty, there was this war, the war on poverty got distorted into a war on crime, which got further distorted into a war on drugs. And so whenever there's a war and you end up destroying a nation, when you end up destroying a state, after you've leveled it to the ground, then there has to be a Marshall Plan to come back in and build it up all over again. And the question is, does Baltimore City need a Marshall Plan? Communities in Baltimore City have been devastated and leveled to the ground, both in terms of financial and human capital. And so it isn't just another rec center. It isn't right. just a little bit more money for the school system. There needs to be a complete revolution in terms of divestment from some resource places and investment in other places to completely rebuild the community so that they once again, it's not that people have forgotten. It's just that the resources are not available to do what needs to be done. And a little investment here and a little investment there isn't going to cut it. It has to be a citywide plan. You just can't. And I don't want to get into this discussion. It's another show. You've already had the show.
What's up?
If you're going to have a TIF for Port Covington, right. where is that plan for the rest of the city?
Right.
Where is that plan for neighborhoods, you know, where more than 20, 30, 40% of the housing is vacant and uninhabitable? Like, you couldn't rehab it. You would just have to raise the entire block to the ground and build it all over again. And that is expensive, but look at the alternative. The alternative is what we have right now, and three more generations of what we have right now that will just get worse and worse and worse. Because, again, I think you're correct. We're at a precipice right now. And my concern, and I try not to give over to hopelessness, but my concern is if we don't do something, if we don't move on this right now, I fear what this city will look like 49 years from now.
I agree. Michaela? So please jump in. I mean, this to me, it seems like, you know, that we are – the difference between then – 1967 and 2016 are some major differences.
Mm-hmm.
One was we were at the end of the war to end segregation, legal segregation. There was a momentum in this country around that because of that, at that moment. There was a huge protest against the war in Vietnam that were taking place at that time, and the Vietnam War was taking place, which took away from the war on poverty because the money was going to the war in Vietnam. And you also had, and I'm not saying this in a partisan sense because I'm not really Republican or Democrat. I don't have a big dog in that fight. But that the reality was that you had moderate and liberal Democrats and Republicans in control of the government that were all talking about you had to have investment in America. We have a very different world politically today as well than we had back then. And I think because of 67... 49 years ago is why you have the rise of a Trump and all the racist forces around Trump in reaction to what, you know, what has happened over the last 40, what has happened and not happened over the last 49
Well, that's
years.
Why, you know, this is where Michelle Alexander got it right and where Brian Stevenson have gotten it right, that we ended legal segregation, but it didn't. We ended legal segregation, but it didn't go away. It just morphed into something else. It morphed into different systems. And that's what we call institutionalized racism and systemic racism is now in the system. So it looks legal, but, you know, it's still very much segregation in many different ways. And the criminal justice system has become sort of like the holder
mm-hmm.
of legal segregation, you know, and then after that, the school system in certain communities. So say all that to say this. There are organizations like BLOC, like No Boundaries Coalition, like Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle, Campaign for Justice, Safety, and Jobs. There are organizations in Baltimore City and other parts of the states that are, I'm not going to say rising up because they've been there the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that, you know, this has given them space and made space for them to be more vocal and more visible than they've ever been before. And the reforms that they're putting forward are not knee-jerk. They are well thought out. They are sophisticated. And if both the community and the quote-unquote powers that be actually respond to what's being proposed by these different groups. Because I think if you look at the No Boundaries report, if you look at the Movement for Black Lives policy platform, if you look at what the Campaign for Justice, Safety, and Jobs are doing, there isn't a whole lot of disagreement. There are some places where there's some departure, you know, because people focus on different things. But to a great extent, particularly around policing reform and investment in community, all of these groups are saying the exact same thing. So it can't be some elected official sitting back and saying, well, we don't know what the community wants us to do. No, the community is telling you exactly, and there are going to be other events. No Boundaries Coalition is going to do a People Summit. Baltimore Action Legal Team is going to be Ignite Baltimore. Open Society Institute Baltimore is doing the Solution Summit on December 10th, 2016. There are going to be many, many ways for groups to engage, just to reiterate what everyone is already saying. And so those who are decision makers and are empowered to help make begin to help make things happen are going to have plenty of places and plenty of ideas of where they can start first and then go next.
So let me, we a lot of people call in and left, so do call back, 410-319-8888. I apologize. We'll get your calls. Let me get a couple calls in here, and I want to come back and just go around the room to Brenda and Michaela Doug and to talk about where you all and Tara, where you all think that we go from here. What should be What if you were can make if you were advocating for change at this moment, and you, some of you are, what would you say our next step should be? What should happen at this moment to push change in our community here? What would that look like, given all the factors we have with the DOJ decree and the police department and all that coming up, a new city council coming in, Port Covington is still going to be debated. There's a lot going on. So what would be our next steps? Where do you think the steps should be, and how should we take them? Let me get a couple calls in here, then we'll jump right into that. 410-319-8888. Andrea, you're on the air. Good morning, hey. Andrea. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Well, I think if change is to be initiated, it can't always be somebody telling us, like the lady said, marshaling us into this. You know, we're not babies, and we're not supposed to be slaves anymore. Everybody's grown here and should have some idea what needs to be done. Number one, we need to police our own community. Number two, you can balk at it all day long. We need to mentally and emotionally separate ourselves from white thought, white thinking, and as much as we can boycott these places that we spend our money foolishly. Every liquor store in any minority community needs to be voted dry and shut down. We don't need alcohol. We're insane enough from all this aggravation and mental disturbance that we've had since we come here. If we don't separate ourselves from this mentality, these are the same people who've been feeding us, clothing us, housing us, and this is how we got here. It's a complete system of brainwash. The reason why this FOB goes on and continues like that, because they're backed by the United States government. I have to give Lyndon Baines Johnson some credit for what he did in the 60s. He attempted to initiate programs directly to fight because he understood causes here because he understood what they were. Obama sits there. He's scared to even say anything about black people as if he's just aloof. So, I mean, this is what we have. We don't have nobody but ourselves. And if we don't depend on ourselves, we're going to perish.
Andrea, thanks for your call. Let me get a couple calls in here, then we're going to go jump right back to our panel. 410-319-8888. Charles, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Good morning, doing? Charles.
Good morning. I was just curious to know if any of the panelists have heard anything with regards to the Vanguard Justice Society putting out any statements, you know, in terms of how they feel about what's been going on, you know, in the city. You know, it's like a black police organization. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I do know, having spoken with some of their membership, that they've been disappointed with some of the young officers, African-American officers that came on once they had more black officers hired. And it's just, it's appalling, you know, to see how some of them behave. You know, like I said, it's disappointing. I'm just wondering what the panelists have to say about it. And then the last thing, and I'll get off and be quiet. I'm curious to know, when they fire some of these guys that they've identified as bad actors, have they been doing any profiling or retention of data to see what took place with these people? How did they get through the screening process, and what were their records? Because possibly you can develop some type of information that can help you in your hiring, you know, in the future.
That's really interesting. I'm going to ask one of our guests specifically, Doug, about that last thing you said. And Vanguard Justice, by the way, just for clarity, they came out in support of the officers during the Freddie Gray case, just to be clear about that. Just they came out in support.
And when Commissioner Batts, before he was invited to leave, wrote op-ed in the Baltimore Sun ostensibly calling them out for not being more vocal around the need for reform.
Right.
The Vanguard Justice Society sort of fought back against even him. So unfortunately, we haven't seen the Vanguard Justice Society sort of be the force for reform that we would hope to see. I'm not familiar with what the leadership is right now. The person who I knew is now chief of the Indianapolis Police, and so I don't know what the organization looks like now.
It'd be interesting to talk to him. I haven't talked to him in a while.
Yes.
Let me get one more call. As I said, three calls, and we'll come right back and everybody respond. Bishop Miles, you're on the air. Welcome. Doug Miles,
yes,
I believe that is.
Good morning. I called in to talk about a little bit about where do we go from here and how it differs from when my generation was this young. The difference is that our generation moved out of an institutional base. You can't fight institutions without having an institutional base in which to fight them, because they just simply outlast you. And that's what tends to happen with individual-driven movements. They outlast you. They pick you off one by one. So as our young folk move forward, my earnest suggestion is that they would develop some institutional base that will outlive individuals to fight this institutional racism that has been a part of the American culture since slavery. Again, the reason the civil rights movement was able to accomplish what it did accomplish, and it didn't accomplish enough, that you know, no one needs to argue that, but it was able to accomplish some things because it came out of an institutional base, and that institutional base then was the Black Church. It provided the spiritual nourishment. It provided the people who could be rallied on a consistent basis and delivered on a consistent basis, and that's what's lacking this time around. What usually happens with movements like this is they allow people to express their anger for a while, then they clamp down. And because there is no institution to fight back, individuals grow discouraged.
Bishop Doug Miles, always good to hear you. We'd like to get you back on the air to have this conversation on the air with a bunch of others. That would be a good thing to do. But let's turn to what we're talking about here. And there's a lot of things to get into. But let me turn to Doug, then we'll go right to Michaela and then Brenda. But Doug, what the one caller said about, Charles said about these officers who have been accused or let go, is that a way to look at how you recruit and what you're looking at and who these people really are?
Absolutely, it is, and most departments do that. So when you look back, and unfortunately, a lot of times in the state police, we'd look back and we'd see red flags that we had missed. You know, you almost always find, wow, why did we hire this person? And then you try and make it better on your recruiting end. That's why I continue to say that we should hire people in that right spirit of service and justice. Now, most all recruits come in and why do you want to be a police officer? Well, the answer almost 100% is I want to help people. But something in the system somehow flips that switch off and turns them into a different type of motivation. That's another piece that has to be answered. Where does that switch get flipped? It shouldn't, right? We should nurture that throughout their career. But unfortunately, in some cases, you know, it becomes that us and them, and that's a problem, right? The other thing I like to comment on is this, you know, tendency of sometimes we look at things in black and white, and it's not that way. If you look at the science and the studies on police departments, you know, a black officer is just as likely to abuse people in the community as a white officer. So it's not really a racial thing. It's a subculture thing in the police that we have to look at. You know, what turns a police officer from I want to help people to some police officer, and I really hope we keep this in perspective. You know, there's still a lot of really good police officers, and even those who are really good are molded by that subculture. So they think they're doing the right thing. They're being told they're doing the right thing. So I hate to just blame them all and paint them as such bad people, because they're not. Many of them are really good, well-meaning people, but they're doing the wrong things because they think that's what is expected of them. There are some on the fringes that you just can't help. They need to go. So it's not just a easy answer.
I don't think it is an easy answer. I mean, I have family who are police. My nephew is a cop. I have students of mine who are police, who are trying to do the right thing. And I talk to them, they're very frustrated by things that happen for levels. I mean, it is complex. I think Nothing is linear. Things are very complex. Very complex. We have to understand the complexity if we're going to do any of this. Michaela, let me go with you, then come to Brenda to start, just about where you would take it now.
So the answer for me and a lot of organizers in this instance, particularly, would be to hand a lot of power over to civilians.
What does that mean?
So an example would be how we have a trial board, and there are no, like, the civilians have no power in that. And so you have police officers, retired police officers, investigating other officers. And so to provide accountability, the solution to that could be adding civilians, people who are not tied to that institution of policing, that can look at the evidence from an objective point of view, but also from the point of view of having to experience the actual brutality and, you know, process that way. Or to have more civilians involved in the actual contract of the FOP, so that way they know, understand, and can change the contract based off things that are happening to the people. Because civilians have that connection with those that are experiencing the brutality versus a cop who sees another cop as an ally, as a brother.
On that note, we'll take a short break. We'll take a quick break here, come right back, and jump to Brenda Sanders and begin this conversation, where we go from here, get back to the phones with your ideas about where we go from here, and wrestle a bit with what Bishop Doug Miles said about this generational thing. Is that real, and what does that mean? 410-319 and institutional base, 410-319-8888. I'll check Twitter here in a moment. Stay with us. This is Mark Steiner. On the way to break, you heard Michaela Duchess Brown, who's head of communications for Be More Block, one of the number of organizations that led the civil disobedience at the FOP convention that took place here in Baltimore. And there's a wide coalition of groups, let me just say to all of you who are part of this. I think that Be More Block, Tyrone West Coalition, the Free Keith Davis Junior Committee, Surge Baltimore, Baltimore-Palestine Solidarity, Baltimore Transgender Alliance, CASA, UGMA's People's Progress, Baltimore IWW, and others were a part of this coalition. So this is a range of really activist groups in the city that led, but I would just say the folks would Be More Block. And I should also say this disclaimer, because he asked me to say this, one of our producers, Mark Henry, is involved in some of these organizations as well. So just put that out there as well as a point of just complete honesty and disclosure here on the show. Which didn't influence what we did, but it just, but we should understand that that's out there as well. And Michaela stays in the studio with us, along with Doug Ward, retired state police officer who's directed Division of Public Safety Leadership in the School of Education at Johns Hopkins University. Tara Hoffman, who is director of OSI Baltimore's Criminal and Juvenile Justice Program, and Brenda Sanders, executive director of Better Health, Better Life Organization. So where would you start, Brenda?
Okay, if I could just address something that Doug said first, because
I think it
was very important for me to address, which is at one point he said that because there are black officers who are just as likely to be engaging in these activities that were highlighted in the report, that it's not a racial thing. And I think if there's anything that this report has made very clear is that it is, in fact, a racial thing, because there are several sections in this report that are specifically, you know, dedicated to showing that black people are disproportionately affected by these illegal and very unconstitutional policing activities. And so I think that we really need to make that distinction, because it is very much a racial issue. It is racism that is rooted and, you know, that is at the base of the activity that's going on with these Baltimore City police officers. And I would also like to say that anybody can be an agent of white supremacy. Anybody can carry out white supremacist activities. You don't have to be white to be an agent of this racially destructive and biased system. And so I just really wanted to point that out.
That is the devious nature of institutionalized racism, is that you don't have to own the philosophy that one race of people is superior to the other. You can actually be a good person in a system that perpetuates systemic or institutionalized racism. And because of the practices, the policies, the culture, how you get rewarded, how you get disciplined, you can be an African-American within an institution that is racialized and that has systemic racism. And as Brenda said, be an agent that perpetuates that and not even realize that you're doing it because now you're just doing your job.
And Brenda, I thank you for that. I think you said it better than I did. I wasn't trying to imply that it wasn't racism involved, institutional racism. I happen to agree with you, but I didn't say it as well as you did, but thank you.
Before we come right back, let me just say that maybe another conversation for another day is, you know, we use this word institutional racism all the time, systemic racism, and I think it's even deeper than that because we talk about our institutions. Mm-hmm. I think there was a psychologist out of Germany, his name was Wilhelm Reich, and he wrote about the mass unconsciousness, a mass consciousness, I should say, that allowed the Nazis to kind of take power. He wrote about that in the 30s. And Jung, Carl Jung, another one, talked about the mass unconsciousness that connects us all. And I think it's that race and racism has become so deeply embedded in the human psyche over the last 600 years mm-hmm. on this planet. It's not, I mean, it's institutional form is one thing, but it's in everybody.
Internalized.
And it acts, and depending on whether you're white or black or whoever you are in America and what role you play in America, you play that out in different ways, what you were saying, Brenda. Mm-hmm. It's deep. I mean, it's really part of the human system. Mm-hmm. And that's the scary part.
And that's why, again, you can have individuals who are white and you call out a certain behavior or conduct that you see them observe him, and they are genuinely offended that you just call them racist because they do not see it. They do not see what they just did, and they will argue you down, and they're not being defensive, and they're not trying to hide. They genuinely do not see that the behavior that they're engaging in is, in fact, racism.
So your first steps, Brenda Sanders, what were you going to say? Sorry.
So as a community activist—
Didn't forget you.
No, great, I appreciate that. So as a community activist, I am most concerned about what's going to be happening on the streets. Because, you know, it's fine to talk about all these things in these theoretical terms and talking, you know, statistics and all of this. But the people, the poor black people in Baltimore communities are the ones who are suffering, are the ones who are being excessively, you know, frisked and excessively arrested. And the excessive force that's being used in dealing with them. And so I want to know what is going to change on the streets today, tomorrow, the next day, because that's, for me, the most important thing. How are people's quality of life going to be improved now that we have this definitive information right here that there is wrongdoing?
So you have, I'm looking at you right now, and you have the report open, and you have numerous notes all around you that you've taken from reading this report. So I'm curious, what so if you look at the report, then where do you think it should begin? Where does that begin?
It's difficult because it's at such a systemic level that, again, I don't have like hope that anything will be able to be done immediately. But at the same time, I feel like something has to be done immediately, like something that we have to pull back all of the power that these officers have in these communities that they're occupying, because that's the way I see it. You know, they're coming from outside the community, policing people in very destructive ways. And I feel like we have to pull back some of that power, like Michaela was saying, and make it so that they don't have the ability to continue with this abuse.
Sorry. So I think that to me, I'm really wrestling with where that starts. You know, I mean, I think that if we didn't have Be More Block chaining themselves to the hotel, many people would not be wakened up, or as people say in nomenclature of the moment, oh, they wouldn't be awoke at this moment to what's happening in the world around us. So that's really critical. The groups like No Boundaries Coalition, you folks at Hopkins, I mean, there has to be a way that this comes together, OSI, that comes together to begin the steps that have to be taken to begin these changes. And, you know, when you say we shouldn't, the police should not, how did you exactly say it about not patrolling? The police officers have to do what? Say that one more.
I was just on a roll, Mark.
So you got to roll back the tape.
Basically, that we have to get these occupying force out of the community. Mm-hmm. So, how do we change the occupying force into a peace officer force that actually works with neighborhoods and doesn't oppress. I mean, that's a huge leap to make, right?
Mm-hmm.
Michaela, I mean, I'll let you jump in. Michaela, do you have a thought here?
I mean,
I know you
think,
do.
I mean, of course, it's not as simple as I'm about to say, but in
but
reality,
no, right.
What needs to happen is that these policing institutions need to be closed down, transformed, because reform is a bandage. They need to be transformed inside and out. Because the reality is policing institutions haven't changed much since the creation and what their role was when they first began and what their role is now. And that's also why it impacts the community in the way that it does, because the way or the understanding of the role of police has been the same since the creation of sheriffs during slavery. So if my job has always been to patrol the poor to keep people in order, until I transform what those policies are, what that culture is, what I think the idea of policing is, none of that matters. So that means they need to be closed down and created from scratch. And that means you need to look at what the alternatives are around the world, because everybody's police force is nothing. It's not like the American police force. There are some way less excessive and aggressive, and then there are some similar to ours because of the influence that America has around the world. And so, like, we need to be looking at these alternative institutions. So, like, I believe in community policing, which means you allow street organizations who already have relationships with folks in the community to go and de-escalate and to be the ones patrolling the neighborhoods, not outside officers that don't understand the culture and the politics within those communities.
So you're about to say something, we'll come over to Tara.
So there are a number of models that you've seen. There's the Camden, New Jersey model, where they just fired the whole police department and start over. That's really drastic, really difficult, really expensive, right? That's one potential model. There's a regional model where you may look at the region of Baltimore, the Baltimore County, Baltimore City, and look to see maybe there's a way to do a regional policing model similar to what you see in boroughs in Pennsylvania, where you combine resources and create a new police department in a regional fashion. Then there's the let's fix the one we have model, which is most likely probably the cheapest, the least difficult, still very difficult, but that's when you need leadership, and you need leadership that's consistent, that's there beyond election cycles, that has the authority to act, right? And that's going to involve issues with the union. You know, how can we fire people? How can we hire the right people? How can we – now, there's a plus here. There's an opportunity here. A police department in most places in this country is a kind of a military model of command and control orders. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, sir, no, sir. Yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. That can be a plus in these situations, because that middle group of officers that are good officers, but they're maybe not doing what they should be doing and could be doing it better, they're going to go where they're told. They're going to do what their reward system demands of them. That's a plus, right? So you get rid of the bad apples on the one end of the spectrum. You hire good people in the spirit of service coming in, and you order the rest of them. This is the way it's going to be done, or else. That's at least a start. But it needs to be – you can't have the organization sit there, well, you know what? We're going to get a new commissioner in a couple of years. Let's just wait it out. Mm-hmm. You need to have a strong statement. This is our commissioner. He or she's going to be here for the next 10 years. That's why we do it with the FBI. The leader's going to be here for 10 years. This is the plan. And I'll bet you if all of us around the table and all the people that have an investment in the city came to the table, there's probably 8 or 10 things we'd all agree on. Start there. There are lots of things we agree. We want to have a just police department and system. We don't want to have institutional racism. Let's start with what we agree on. Stop arguing about the things on the fringes will never change, and stop pointing fingers at one another. So we need leadership.
I'll start at the ground and work my way up. To Bishop Miles' point about institutions, this is a conversation, I'll say, that is happening even within the philanthropic community, because foundations are used to funding institutions. They're not used to funding movements. And so figuring out how to fund this movement, but also to institutionalize the movement so it can't get weighted out and it can't get picked apart, continues to be a challenge, and we continue to struggle with it. And we reach out to the folks like, you know, Open Society Institute Baltimore, over the last year has made you know, more than $1 million of investments in groups. Some of those groups are very institutionalized and well-known, like Casa de Maryland and the ACLU of Maryland. Other of these groups are, you know, not well-funded at all, but they got a lot of energy, like Leaders for Beautiful Struggle or the coalition that came together under the moniker of Baltimore United for Change, which included Baltimore Block and City Block. And even now we're having conversations with groups about how to get resources to them in a more direct fashion so that they can continue to do the work because they're needed. They're very much needed. They can't go away. And we cannot allow, we who are connected to institutions cannot allow them to be marginalized as terroristic. You know, we can't let that happen. We can't buy into that frame. We have to resist that frame from the very beginning. And so I think that I think one thing is to continue to support the activists, because they are the ones who are connected to the community. I'm not an organizer. I learned a long time ago that I'm not an organizer. I don't try to pretend to be an organizer. I'm a lawyer. And so also recognizing, what is your assignment? Because my assignment is not to be out there handcuffing myself to buildings. But I do have the assignment to make sure that the people who get handcuffed to the buildings and get to a lawyer to get out of jail real quick and go back and be handcuffed to another building to make sure that they keep it up. So that's what happens and has to happen at the street. And I think that anyone within the I'm calling out the philanthropic community, we have got to support this movement and support these groups and help them find a way to become institutionalized so that they are able to sustain as long as this is going to take, because it's not going to be a few years. Moving to leadership, I have to commend Commissioner Davis. He's not going to see the end of this thing, but he's there right now, and there are things that he can do, must do, and things that he is doing to begin to implement reforms in the Baltimore Police Department. There are some people who are never going to engage with him because he's part of the system, but there are other people who can put supports around him and help give him, I don't want to say he needs political cover because I don't find him to be a coward, but he does need to know that when he makes a move, he's not going to go the way of Commissioner Batts. And I'll just put it out there. He has to stay there long enough to really be able to move some things, and that means he's going to need the support of people outside of the department as well as the department to make that happen. Open Society Institute Baltimore is happy and will continue to make those kind of investments to help make that happen, but it's also going to have to be people, you know, within certain parts of the community as well. And then I think the last point in terms of immediately, I'll go back to this. And again, this is where I go because I'm a lawyer. This is my assignment. The consent decree is a place to engage immediately. As you've said, Mark, this is going to happen. And it's not going to be a panacea. It's not going to fix everything. But this document will drive the investment of resources for a long time. And for that reason, we have to be engaged in exactly what that document says, and then who's monitoring it to make sure that it actually gets implemented and it doesn't just sit on the shelf. Do not sleep on this consent decree process.
And I think that speaks to what I started the program with, that this consent decree has to involve not just the police and City Hall, but has to involve the community. People have to be directly involved. People have to be not afraid to allow the Michaelas and Brendas to sit on the commissions that make the changes, that are part of the process. That's the only way it changes. You know, I think that's a big piece of this. It can't, otherwise it could just tumble into the same process it has other places, and the lasting effects won't be there. We have a chance to make some lasting effects if we play it right. And it won't be a panacea at all. I mean, we still have all the oppression and the poverty and racism that exists. But I'm saying we won't even begin to put a deep change into any of this process unless communities involved in the midst of that change.
It's one tool. It is one tool in our toolbox. And because of the transformation that does need to happen, we cannot afford to let any tools in that toolbox get ignored. All of them have to be sharpened. And be as sharp as they possibly can, and be, you know, as utilitarian as they possibly can, so that every lever that is available to us, we can pull on it to bring about the change that we want to see.
So let me try to get a couple phone calls here. We're almost out of time, and I want to get sure that the other voices come back in here. Let's go to Gladys. You're on the air. Try to get as many of you. I know many of you have been holding on for a long time. I'm sorry. We can only get to so many people. We do our best. Gladys, you're on the air. Then we're going to go to Floyd, who's been waiting a long time as well.
Yeah. You know, all your resolutions.
Gladys, could you?
Your resolution sounds real good and everything. But I definitely believe, number one, the same constitution we're going through said that we had no right in this country to any legal way. So that's debunked. You have to go back to that. The last thing I want to leave you with is the guy who used to be known as Stokely Carmichael, or Kwame Nkrumah. He said before a group can enter the open society, it must first close ranks. That means that we, as a people, have to close ranks with each other. That means unification, which we don't have. As long as we don't have it, everything and everyone will come between us, and we're going to stay forever like we are.
Gladys, thank you so much. Floyd, you're on the air.
Mark, thank you for the call. Everybody's always expressed everything I've been thinking of for a long time. And I think that Auschwitz and Wounded Knee are good examples of what are going on here in Baltimore right now with the police department. The police department only, unfortunately, does it with deadly force. And that means that the evolution of the system itself that we see is not bringing about no life change here in this system. It's all about, as many of your panelists have spoken out, the change that has to happen is an evolution that we have to choose. And because all life is a process of recreation, and God's greatest joy is this recreation. And what I want to make sure that you understand, you always, Mark, I sometimes say that you understand when you talk about water, who we are. We're made up of water. Water has a consciousness. Akimoto talks about this from Japan. And what I don't see is that the lawyers, who are all trained liars, and the businessmen, who are all greedy thieves, you know, that's just, they're brain dead. They just want to make money. They don't care about people. They don't want to see people thrive and live. And because of that, we are living in a system right now, as one of your panelists pointed out, based all the way back to white supremacy and slavery, and we've talked about this many times, but we must evolve past that. We must get a system set up here in this country, in this city, in this world, that will allow people to not only thrive, grow, and be part of a consciousness that makes us survive as a species. Thank you, Mark, for having me speak.
Thank you so much. Let's get some thoughts here before we close out. So we can't get any other calls. I do want to get some closing thoughts. And I would just say this, my own philosophical point of view here is I don't believe in ever that all of anything is anything. So whether it's all business people, all black folks, all lawyers, all Jews, or whatever, there is no all. But we have to make a real kind of dent in our society and make change. I think we're at that point. We're at a point like the end of the Civil War, the fight to end segregation. We're at another critical social point in America that has come to us, and we've got to kind of realize that's where we are, and it's time to move. Let's go around the table here with our final thoughts. We'll just go right around. Tara, and then mm-hmm. Michaela, and then Brenda, and Doug.
So I would just say two things. One, Mark, you said that this is not linear, and it's very much not going to be linear. It's going to be multifaceted, multi-levels, and there isn't such thing as a place to start. There are many places to start. And so I would say if you are a person who's concerned about what's going to happen next, there's a place for you to engage, and you may need to do some homework mm-hmm. to figure out what that place is. But this is not a place for anyone in the city to sort of sit back and say so-and-so has it. This is a place. There's a place for every business community, faith community, wealthy folk up in Roland Park, you know, down to folks in Upton. And there's a place for everyone to engage, and it's to find your place and engage and help to move the city forward. And then again, I'm going to do my job and invite everyone to come out on December 10th to the Solution Summit that Open Society Baltimore Institute is sponsoring. You can go to make sure I get the website right, osisolutionssummit.org, to find out more details. And there are going to be pre-events before the big event. And so if you see information, we ask that you come on out and be with us, because we definitely want to get the voice of the community to let our officials coming in know exactly, you know, where we believe that Baltimore City can move in the next, year or two. Very concrete things that the city, that the mayor and the city council can do without state intervention and without federal intervention.
Michaela, Duchess Brown.
One of the last things I would say is when we're talking about who should be involved in the process, we have to keep in keep in mind it should be those directly affected and or the most marginalized in these communities that should be at the table first. Because if you uplift those that are all the way at the bottom, you create and impact the conditions for everyone else. So that means, for example, the DOJ report talks about the force used on women. Women should be at the table. Or poor people should be at the table, not traditionally those who have influence sitting at the table. It should be those directly impacted by the decisions or institutional racism that should be at these tables when we're trying to make change.
That's a really powerful, important point. Really important point. We can push that over the coming weeks. Brenda Sanders.
Yeah, everything Michaela said. But also, I would encourage people to read this report.
I would too.
Really, really well. I think even
it's a lot
for
to
me,
wade through, but I agree.
It is. And even for me, and I grew up in the most marginalized communities in Baltimore, and it still hit me like a ton of bricks. It's like you know what's going on, and you see it, and you even experience it, but there's something about the validation of a government agency coming in and saying, you're right, we believe you. That is, you know, it hits you hard, but it also can be a very healing experience as well. And I think everybody, it's about 160 pages, y'all. Everybody should read this and really internalize this information because it's important.
Doug Ward.
It strikes me that there are a lot of people who care about the city of Baltimore. And there are a lot of people who need to be involved. I couldn't agree more with all the other panelists and what they say, who should be involved. The only thing I hope everyone does is listen more, empathize more, point fingers less, because none of this will work if we keep trying to blame everyone else. There's a role for all of us, and I think that the majority of people, from no matter what facet you see this problem, can agree on more things than they can disagree, and I think there are people of good intent who can find the solutions together, but we've got to get beyond this ignoring or trying to say this is not happening or you're to blame or you're, you know, we've got to get beyond that because that stifles everything else. It puts walls up between us and it won't solve anything. So if we can just listen more, realize that we don't have all the answers ourselves and that everyone is entitled to their perspective.
Mm-hmm. SolutionsSummitBaltimore.org. I got the website wrong. SolutionsSummitBaltimore.org. Thank you.
I love Tara. Tara Hoffman. It's right. You always have Baltimore's criminal and justice, juvenile justice program. You heard just before that Doug Ward, director of the Division of Public Safety in the School of Education at Johns Hopkins University. Brenda Sanders, executive director of Better Health, Better Life Organization and co-organizer of the Vegan Soul Fest coming up next weekend, which we've been covering as well. And Michaela Duchess Brown, head of communications for Be More Block. Thank the four of you and Todd Oppenheim earlier for being with us today. And over the coming week, we'll be looking at this very intensely. I may not be around much this week. I have some family issues I have to deal with, but we have great people coming in to sit in for us during the week to take over this discussion and keep it alive. And I'll remind you on the way out of here, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ Baltimore's Credit Union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ Baltimore's Credit Union is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production center for emerging media. Senior producer Mark Gunnery. Producer is Imani Spence. Engineer is Andre Melton. Interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Theme music by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts to talk@steinershow.org. Podcast the Steiner Show. And visit us on the web at steinershow.org or use your favorite podcasting app. I'm your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.